folks are able to hold space for their discomfort and still kind of lean in, and other folks aren't. And yeah, I'm really, really interested in being in conversation with the people who are able to hold some space for their discomfort, even if they have questions.
I first met Christina Cleveland across the street from a conference, where later that day she'd speak on issues of race and the long road toward unity among Christians. Her presentation was 3 minutes long. I left that conference with not just what I heard from Dr. Cleveland on stage, but eyes somewhat newly opened to a system and a culture that was comfortable nodding towards that which was non-white and non-male, but far less interested in fully investing. I also left with an awareness of my own complicity in that system, in that culture. Since then, I've paid close attention to Dr. Cleveland's work as an author, a blogger, a speaker, a culture creator, and I've looked forward to this interview for a really long time, which brings me to this somewhat unfortunate and slightly comical production note. My two-year-old has developed, we'll call it an interest, in my electronics. And just before I got Dr. Cleveland on the line, she was playing around with the input controls. You'll hear my voice peak and distort off and on through this conversation. That said, Dr. Cleveland's voice is clear as day and full of wisdom for the moment we are in. Check it out. Where are you calling from right now? Where are you actually?
I'm at home in Durham, North Carolina.
You're in Durham. No, you're not from North Carolina.
Oh God, no. No, I'm from California.
I know. I know. You, which I will come back to this. You were out here for the Olafur Arnold show a little while. We'll come back to that in a minute, but you grew up in California. Mm-hmm. You're now in North Carolina. Do you have a place, or do you have multiple places you consider home? Where's home for you in your heart?
That's a really good question. Probably New Hampshire, because I went to high school and college there. So I feel attached to it. I'm actually heading to New Hampshire this week to speak there. Strangely, New Hampshire. But I left home when I was 15 to go to boarding school. So even though I grew up in the Bay Area, I haven't lived there in over 20 years, almost 20 years now. So
is that a matter of like the time you spent in New Hampshire? Like, why is it just?
It's just coming of age. Okay. You know, like I think I had to become an adult because I was at school.
Right.
I think my faith changed a lot during that time because I was on my own. So it became more personal to me. And I just think it's beautiful.
It's very true.
Yeah. I don't know that I'd ever live there, but when I think of, you know, where I feel like I'm, returning somewhere and even this weekend, like my high school basketball coach is driving over an hour and a half to come see me.
Oh my gosh.
And hang out with like an old college professor who was like so significant in my spiritual formation. In a lot of ways, very important people in my life live there have lived there too. Yeah. So, and my best friend lives in Boston. So, that's another, you know, New England connection that I have. Yeah.
The more I've picked up on the Bay Area connections for you, I don't think I knew early on that you had like a Bay Area tie, but then when you came out for the show, I was going to go to the show, and then a few things came up.
Are you an Olafur fan?
A huge fan.
I love him.
Yeah. I was going to ask you sort of like connected. Are you familiar at all with Slow Meadow?
No.
I'll send you a recommendation. He's sort of like he hits me in a similar way as Sigur Rós does, where it's like there's stuff that functions in the same realm, but not with the same focus and expertise. Like he's like really actually up to something there, where it feels like a lot of other folks in that musical genre are like tinkering. Like he feels like he's like found something. He's focused. He's actually working with material.
Oh, he's so much more sophisticated than so many others. And I think you're a music person, right?
Yeah, have been.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I'm not. So, I mean, I was like in an a cappella group in college, so I'm not like a legit person, but I can just, his work is, so what's interesting is I've seen Olafur three times in concert, just because like I love him that much, and that's like so rare for me. I don't really do that kind of stuff, but I saw him when he was in New York last summer, in a really small venue in the in Greenwich Village, and then I saw him in January. And when I was in January, I invited my sister, but she was unable to come, and so at the last minute, I invited my friend Marlena. And they are 68 years old and have been practicing Buddhism for like 30 plus years.
Yeah.
And they said, like, this was transformational.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. I feel like I had a really deep spiritual experience.
Yeah.
And then they afterwards bought his CD.
Which is amazing that he had them, but
yeah, right. But I think what was interesting and one of the things that was really neat about me and Marlena being there is obviously we're like an intergenerational friendship, and he has tons of like hipster, millennial, urban types, and then he also has, because of the Broadchurch soundtrack, like half the audience was like baby boomers and older,
So
it was actually pretty fun for Marlena because they were like not. They didn't feel out of place. Yeah, at this like concert, you know, because they didn't know exactly what. Like they knew that I like him a lot, but they didn't know what to expect. So yeah, he's really fun. Yeah, he's great. I'm trying to convince my spouse to plan a trip to go visit one of his friends in Zurich on November 9th.
To go catch another gig.
November 9th. And I'm like, oh, because it'd be so fun to be there. He's like, it'll be cold. I'm like, but it's beautiful in Zurich in the winter. And he's like, really? Why? I'm like, because Olafur's going to be there.
Yeah, there you go.
But we're planning a trip anyway. I mean, we want to go visit his friends. So it's kind of like, well, why not go then? So we'll see. I don't know. But yeah.
Patreon journey, this is sort of like the newest like cultural good of yours, like gathering people to Patreon and like setting up kind of a community there. This is sort of a new endeavor. Can you talk a little bit about, like, for folks who've seen you about and are wondering like what specifically this is, you've decided to gather people to Patreon. Why? What are you actually up to there with Patreon? Can you describe what you're trying to do?
Sure. I blogged and blogged and blogged and blogged my little heart out for years back when people used to blog. And I enjoy that process. At heart, I'm a public theologian. And so I've always felt relatively comfortable sharing ideas very publicly and very... like vulnerably, in the sense that it hasn't gone through 8 rounds of revisions and peer reviews, and I maybe don't 100% agree with everything I'm saying, or it's not finalized, but I'm just putting it out there in conversation, because I think that's what, we need conversation starters, and I'm willing to be that person. So I enjoy that. I think there are a couple downsides to that. One is that you really don't know who your audience is, and there's no real commitment from your audience to hold what you're offering with care. And I found, as someone who had a fairly large blog platform, especially for a Christian Christian leader, I found that the more viral a piece went, the more it spiraled out of my control, my even like control in terms of like, now people were reading it that like, we're not, in terms of where they were on their journey, we're not ready to receive anything that I had to say with care as a Black woman or about justice or about whatever I was thinking of. And so I just got like, just pummeled with hate mail all the time. Like personal, like, you know, in my mailbox, in my email inbox. And then there's also the downside too of doing all this creative work and not being compensated at all, or not being supported, or not inviting people into that process as supporters, which I think is just a really beautiful possibility.
Yeah.
I was wanting to get back into producing content more regularly. That, I mean, I've been writing books, I've been writing academic articles. I'm faculty at Duke, so there's like a bunch of writing I've been doing, but it hasn't been for public consumption. And so a friend of mine who's like artsy suggested Patreon. I'd never heard of it.
I got this artsy friend, and yeah, the artsy friend said,
yeah, he was totally like, I think this could be a good fit for you. And I looked at it and I was kind of like, I'm not a poet or like someone with a car, so I'm not sure why you mean that. But he was right, because it certainly has been overwhelming in terms of the enthusiasm and participation. And really, like you mentioned, the community, which feels very sacred to me. I was pretty intentional about the branding of it, if you want to call it that, because I do have like just a very diverse audience. Mm-hmm. And I'm more interested at this point in my theological and spiritual journey. I'm really interested in devoting time to engaging with the people who are ready to run and want to be challenged. And like, I'm not expecting everyone to agree with me. I'm not expecting everyone to be me theologically. But I think I've dealt with enough pushback and hate mail and straight up violence, actually, that it was pretty important for me to launch my Patreon around some themes that would repel the people that probably just need to not really be in conversation with me anymore.
right.
And invite in the people who are curious or gung-ho or wherever they are, but at the very least can hold some space for what I'm offering. So I was intentional about making it about like my virtual Black Madonna pilgrimage, as opposed to like, I don't know, conflict in congregations or something that like probably would have attracted more people maybe, but maybe not the people who are willing to be as daring as I'm wanting to gather around me at this point. If that makes sense.
It was one of the questions I had, like something you might've learned about yourself. What have you actually learned about yourself or what this is actually allowing for you in the process? And yeah. I think, tell me if I'm getting this wrong. Part of what I'm hearing you say is like, it kind of gives you not even like a permission, but like a space wherein you can actually dive more directly into, hey, here's the stuff that I'm actually doing, that I'm actually about. And if you're actually interested in having this conversation as a conversation, the gateway in is investment and not just that you have a freaking opinion. That like the gateway into conversation with Christina Cleveland on the specifically, and we're going to talk about the Black Madonna Project. But if you want to talk about this, that's great. But there's going to have to be some investment in this conversation on your behalf before you get all the way in, as opposed to like, hey, I have this like knee-jerk reaction to the idea of Blackness, period, and I have a thing I want to say. Is that sort of, am I getting close to there?
Yeah, sure. And it's also, you know, on the one hand, I would absolutely say that. And I would say on the other hand, I love the idea of community, and I love the idea of creating space for other people to connect. The more I interrogate patriarchy in really all religion, but specifically Christianity, because that's my my spirituality of origin. The more I just hate like the guru model or the priestly model, or And so a lot of it too is just helping some of those other folks connect with each other. And actually, what's been really beautiful about the work that I've been doing is I've heard of multiple groups of people around the world who are gathering together to discuss the content, which I just think is like, that's like one of the most beautiful things in the world to me.
The folks are picking up on what's happening you're putting things out that the folks are picking up on it, and they're actually allowing what you're doing to muck about in their own minds and then creating space of their own.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of what's neat about gathering a group of people who are perhaps, perhaps, you know, willing to ask questions that that maybe they haven't been able to before, or have been taught not to ask, or that their community is not asking, is that a lot of those folks are seekers who are doing a lot of seeking alone. And so the Patreon page sort of creates a space for people to connect with each other and to resonate with each other, with each other's comments. And it's been neat to just hear stories of people saying, like, yeah, I messaged that person because I liked what they wrote about, you know, in response to what you said, and I wanted to have a deeper conversation, and now we're friends, you know? And I think people are looking for compassionate people to ask questions and to seek with.
Yeah. Does that trust of that kind of person? I want to talk about the being a public theologian, because you said a couple of things that are really interesting for me. One is when you're talking about being a public theologian, that what you are doing is you're allowing folks to bear witness to your own process, that you like, you're comfortable saying, like, you're comfortable saying publicly things that, like, I'm 70-80% on this, but there's stuff that I'm not totally sure. I might disagree with myself in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Is it easy for you, or is it natural for you to trust that process publicly? How should I say this? That, like, insofar as like other people going to be involved, trust other people to pick that up and be responsible to what you're putting on the table?
No, not the average person, especially because I'm a Black woman and we're so distrusted and seen as dirty because we're at the intersection of femaleness and Blackness.
Right.
So no. I mean, and that's why I think blogging, even though I have the constitution to be a public thinker, it was very painful for me because
It was personally painful or like culturally painful?
What did you say?
Do you mean like personally painful? Like you felt personally attacked, which is I'm sure true, but also are you saying like it was culturally painful to watch the thing not go well?
Yeah, I would say both. Yeah. And also like it's not just about the attack, because I don't mind attack if it's like if you just disagree. I think what's hard is when people are distrusting of who I am because of the body that I show up in, you know, like if a white man said it, it'd probably be okay. But because I'm saying it, you know, it's problematic or just other reasons. So yeah, I think, you know, both culturally and personally, and I still did it, you know, and I still have the personality to fight through that, but I think it makes it more difficult to be as vulnerable. Yeah. And I think I was a lot more careful about publishing things that I could stand by more or less, or that I could at least defend even, you know, logically according to Western logic. Whereas now, you know, I'm just not as interested in systematics and in apologetics. And, I'm interested in mystery, and I'm interested into integrating lots of different ideas that maybe we haven't been taught to integrate before.
And that value shift for you, I mean, that's sort of been present in your work for a while. I mean, your first book dives towards that as sort of, because you weren't trying to say with disunity in Christ, it wasn't a matter of like, hey, let's be unified just for the sake of unity. But there are things here in the mix that we don't get to unless we live in these weird tensions between us.
Right.
The movement away from that kind of certainty for you personally, like towards mystery, what does it look like for you personally? Like, where do you find, because if you're the one, here's where I'm coming at. Like, if you're the one, you're still the one whose name is on the Patreon page. So how do you, like, how does it work in your heart, your mind to be in spaces of mystery? Are there particular places in which like, hey, here's, here's something that's on the table for me, and I'm processing aloud. Like, what's it look like for you to do that personally and then share it publicly?
Totally. Yeah. So the series that I'm wrapping up right now, the Christ Our Black Mother, Seven Last Words of Christ Our Black Mother series.
Yes.
I got that idea and was just like, I have no idea what's going to come out.
Right. Can you, for listeners who won't know what that is, I've been pushing that through Instagram, what have you. But for listeners who are like more unfamiliar with you, you're doing this Lenten series, The Seven Last Words of Christ, Our Black Mother. Can you like give a quick, like, this is what this project is and then dive in?
Yeah. The seven last words of Christ, or the seven last things that Christ said on the cross. And in the Black church tradition, if you show up at a Black church this Friday night, there's a good chance that the Good Friday service will be seven mini sermons by seven different people on the seven last words of Christ. So like things like Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. I thirst, those words, those last words. And that's like a Black church tradition. So I wanted to examine those words, those seven last things that Christ said before Christ died, but also think about how the fact that we only associate Christ with maleness and typically whiteness, although there is some Black liberation theology that, you know, identifies Christ as Black on the cross, but for the most part. So I wanted to really challenge our like assumptions around gender and race and Christ on the cross. And so every week I've been going on and it's been an embodied project too, which I think has been beautiful. I've been walking on plantations in North Carolina, mainly because so much of our world is still a plantation. And each week I have been reflecting on one of the seven last words and then writing a short reflection for Patreon from the perspective of, you know, what would Christ be saying if Christ were a Black woman on a plantation on the cross, saying these seven last words. And so, you know, I had that idea and then I very intentionally decided not to engage my private library of like 5,000 books or Duke's library.
Right.
To like figure out what I was going to say, you know, like, and so it was really walking along in this, the mystery of it, like, what am I going to feel that week? You know, there's 7 weeks of Lent, there's 7 weeks of these seven last words. Nothing was planned out. It was just, we're going to walk and we're going to reflect and whatever comes to mind as I'm walking these plantation grounds. I've been walking primarily a plantation called Stagville Plantation. That's about 50 square miles. So it's really big. It's not far from my house here. And, so I think in that sense, I've been embracing mystery. Like, obviously I have some ideas around God, race, and gender.
Right.
And I have some ideas about what it means to be a Black woman. And I have some ideas about plantation life and history. But it all coming together has been very, like, I sit down for no more than 60 to 90 minutes and just write after I go for a walk. Hmm. And whatever comes out is what comes out.
And so by not referencing your book collection or Duke's book collection, I think what I'm hearing you say, tell me if I'm getting this wrong, is you weren't looking for confirmation that your ideas were landing in some sort of like academic or cultural context. You're literally letting this idea.
Can I defend this? Or, you know, no, none of that. It's just, what am I feeling? What's coming to mind? What feels right? You know, how can I trust my intuition? How can I trust my embodied experience as a Black woman and the image of God in me, that speaks through that experience. And then I've also been, you know, really intentional about listening to the responses from people of color who don't identify as men, particularly on Patreon, and like what resonates with them and what doesn't, like what are the questions that come up? What are the things, I mean, people have said that, you know, this seemed really triggering to me, or this seemed like, really hard for me to process. And, you know, like just even learning from those responses, because we all, you know, we all have like a unique perspective on who God is and how God is in this world. And so,
which is theology, like what's going on in me personally when I think about who God is, that is theology. Theology is not a thing that lives in books that I try to get in me. It's theology is actually happening in me, which is part of what you're getting after is like, instead of trying to find a theological context in a book or a library for what's happening in you in these reflections, it's enough for you that this is what's happening in you to share it publicly. And you're sort of leading out to let folks and lead folks into, hey, what's happening in you is actually the thing that counts. Like that's not just whether or not you can find it in the book or find it in some other broader theological context. Is that?
And how's it transforming? You know, cause I think so much of theology is dead, you know, and I think good theology should transform us. And I was actually talking with someone about this last night, another Black woman. I was just like, you know, if my heart is softer, if I have more love for myself and more love for my neighbors, then I had an encounter with God, you know, whether it was at church or whether I was walking in the woods or whether I was reading a book of Buddhist poetry, you know? Just using a different metric even of, you know, what counts as a spiritual experience or a theological experience. And so I think, you know, I think something like the seven last words of Christ, our Black mother, is scary to some people. And so some folks are able to hold space for their discomfort and still kind of lean in, and other folks aren't. And yeah, I'm really, really interested in being in conversation with the people who are able to hold some space for their discomfort, even if they have questions or something doesn't sit right, you know?
I'd love for you to talk about one of the other projects you mentioned earlier and one of the other projects that's featured and talked about at the Patreon page, which is the Black Madonna Project. You spent 18 weeks?
Just five. I wish it was 18.
No. There are 18 Black Madonnas. Is that what it was?
Oh, yeah. 18 Black Madonnas.
I'm getting my number. I was English major, philosophy minor. I don't do numbers. So you spent 5 weeks traveling to these 18 locations with Black Madonnas. Can you talk about the impetus for the idea? Talk about the project. Talk about your process. It's a fascinating. It's more than fascinating. I think it is. It's culturally and hopefully personally for folks who engage, transformative work that you've done and are doing. And so, like, what was the impetus? Like, how did you come into it? What was that like to do?
So my first book, so I feel like my relationship to white Christianity has always been really complex, because my first book was with InterVarsity Press, and I didn't know anything about the publishing landscape when I signed with them. And I don't necessarily have any regrets per se, but what it did was it put me in conversation with a lot of people who did not have much theology to think beyond God as a white man. And that was just sort of that was the implicit understanding. And I think that's the implicit understanding in the United States.
You mean sort of like it's the default. If I'm not thinking, this is what I'm thinking.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, I think even people who would claim that, you know, that to reject this idea that like Jesus is a white man, it probably is still on a non-conscious level, like the default. Right. And because it's just part of American culture.
Yeah.
And, we just associate God with whiteness and God with maleness in so many powerful ways. Like, I mean, one thing that comes to mind that I might've mentioned on pilgrimage is just like on like every US coin and bill, there's like a white man and a thing that says "In God We Trust." So there's just all these connections.
Yeah.
And so that's always been something that's been really hard for me. And I've noticed, how little space there were in so many of the communities that I was doing my work for any questions about that. Any questions about God's blackness or God's femaleness, or just the fact that God's not exclusively white and male. And, I think after, you know, I've always been passionate about, like, Jesus wasn't white. I wrote an article for Christianity Today in, I think, 2015 or 2016 that basically all I said was Jesus is not white. And like, I got just more, just ridiculous, like death threats. It was crazy. Like I was dealing with the Duke police all the time for like a whole month. It was horrible.
If I remember, it wasn't a very complex piece.
Oh my gosh.
It was pretty, it was like, hey, if we're going to pay attention to basic history.
Oh yeah. No. I mean, it was like, first of all, like it's literally like you cannot find a respected historian of any race or religion who would disagree with that.
And so, and this is part of what you're saying about your Patreon space, though, is if I write that piece,
yeah,
then folks are like, hey, that's great insight. Appreciate that.
I have students who were afraid to come to class because everybody in the whole world knows when and where my classes are because it's like published on the Duke website. They had to take my name off of my door, my office door, like, because all these people were coming after me, all these Christianity Today readers were coming after me or threatening to come after me.
Different face, different context. And it changes the way we engage the context of the truth we're telling changes the way we receive that truth and whether or not we're threatened by it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, so I think, you know, and that was just tackling Jesus's blackness or non-whiteness. But then there are all these other issues that our culture has with feminine wisdom.
Yeah.
Or this possibility that God's not exclusively male, which again is something that a lot of moderate to progressive Christians would say, yeah, of course, God is spirit. God's not male or female until you start trying to call God mother. Then all of a sudden they get upset, you know.
Which has always been that strange line is anyone who's serious about any form of theology, like, can't land on God is a male. And that's fine until you call God a woman. Mm-hmm. And then you run into this other realm of like, this is not okay, even though I don't have a real theological foot to stand on to say why, because I'm saying God is not male.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's so deep. I mean, the misogyny and the white supremacy that runs through our culture, I mean, it's so deep, and we've just been raised in it, you know? And so, you know, I think even though I was very aware and I had been kind of like a national justice leader around racism in the Christian church, I don't think I had really interrogated sexism or misogyny in the Christian church to the extent. I mean, like, I was aware of some stuff. Like, I lived in Minneapolis for 5 years. I knew that I would never be invited. I preached at Greg Boyd Church multiple times. I knew I would never be invited to preach John Piper's, right? Like, I mean, there's stuff that, like, I didn't even waste time thinking about.
Yeah.
But then when Trump got elected, I actually was shocked. Like, I wasn't shocked that he got elected, but I was shocked when he boasted of sexually assaulting white women.
Yes.
Because I was like, wow, like they're definitely going to come to the defense of their own women. You know what I mean? Like, and so I think that was a major turning point for me when I realized, I think I don't just have issues with white God, I have issues with male God too, you know, or exclusively male God actually. And that's when, you know, right after Trump's election, I did a deep dive, and I was just like, what are the, and since my spirituality is rooted in Christianity, it continues to be, I was like, are there any, like, talking to my spiritual director, talking to some of my, like, kind of older and wiser, a little bit more eccentric Christian friends, I was like, are there any images of God as black and female, like in the history of Christianity, you know? And then that's when someone pointed me to the Black Madonna. And I was like, what? And it was one of those experiences where it's like, you know, January 2017 or whatever. So 2.5 years ago, a little over 2 years ago now, when it's like in one afternoon, I became a devotee, you know, like I was just like everything in my soul was looking for this image of God, this metaphor for God that identifies with the marginalized, but specifically women of color who are marginalized and who is embodied and connected to, and just connected to the earth, and often shows up in like forests and on mountains and in like lakes, and who is hidden, you know, is a major force within Catholicism.
Yes.
But has still been very much hidden and stamped out by patriarchy in both Protestantism and Catholicism. And so I just read and read and read and read. And I feel like I just adopted her for myself.
Okay.
As a metaphor.
But visual. But I mean, like, it's for me, it's really important that, like, it wasn't just the idea.
Mm-mm,
of
no.
blackness and femininity. It was an actual visual that was like, there's like an actual visual representation.
Oh, totally. Cause I mean, all throughout Duke Divinity School, there are pictures of white God all over the place, stained glass windows, sculptures. You go into Duke Chapel, tons of pictures of white male God. Also massive statue of Robert E. Lee, you know, another white male God, you know? And so, I mean, I think part of it, a lot of it's the visual, and also the history and the stories and the communities of, I mean, there are hundreds of like famous black Madonnas around the world, but they're like bajillions of black Madonnas around the world. And so I went and visited the really famous one in Montserrat, outside Barcelona, Spain that year. And then I also went to Costa Rica to visit, La Negrita, who is the patron, of all of Costa Rica, the patroness of the poor. And so that I had gone to visit a couple just individually and had found those to be really meaningful, especially when I was in, Costa Rica, because, most people don't know this because of white supremacy, but like a lot of Costa Ricans are brown. They look like me, especially the poor ones. And so they're not in the areas that like American tourists surf at and stuff. But if you travel around the country, it's like very much a brown country, black country. And in the poorest spaces, they had these grottos, these like altars created out of garbage, broken glass, trash, just really deep. And I was just amazed at how much the people there found sustained hope and this idea that God is with us, even though the whole force of Westernism is against us. And so I think that very much embodied God, like the imminence of God is just so powerful to me in the image of the Black Madonna. Cause so much of white male God is like kind of like Father Sky, detached from the earth, figure it out, you know, you're kind of a nuisance to me. And so all the metaphors that we have for Jesus, that suggest otherwise were always hard for me to understand because that's not what had been communicated to me.
Correct.
In church, it was always like, you gotta be perfect. You gotta have it together. You know, I taught at a lot of evangelical colleges and it was just like a lot of policing. Like you have to always sign these creeds and statements of belief and community conduct things. And very little was there's a lot of obedience required and not a lot of, kind of like internal connection.
Process like faith. Like it doesn't engage like faith. It doesn't engage like a faith and a process. It's not this grace oriented, like relationship, all the things that get communicated from up front, all the,
away. And yeah, you know, like for example, when I was at Westmont, one of my colleagues fathered a child out of wedlock or something like that, and then that person essentially got banished from the school. I mean, just like stuff where it's like, what is going on here? Like, and it was like, you know, some decision made from on high, you know. A lack of relationality. And so I think when I finally encountered the Black Madonna and all that she stands for, and all that, and the fact that she's like all over the world. I mean, there are Black Madonnas on every continent. Well, maybe not. I don't think I've seen any in like Antarctica, but every other continent, I've at least heard of them. which is really powerful. So then, yeah. So then last year I was, this past year I've been on leave from Duke. And so, even though I'm a newlywed, I talked with my husband. I'm like, hey, I'd love to go do a long pilgrimage. I actually do a lot of pilgrimages. Just in my practice. My
some of them have to do with Olafur. Some of them don't.
Right. and so, you know, I thought, why not take this time to go and visit a bunch of Black Madonnas, especially because this region in France is just like a hotbed. Like there were like 55 or so pretty famous ones in that region. And then when I connected with my friend Jonathan Stalls, who runs Intrinsic Paths, which is like a contemplative walking organization, he's the one who convinced me to walk it. As a way to reconnect with the earth and my body as a Black woman. And so I walked a little over 400 miles in that 5 weeks. So I walked to most of them and I didn't use any private transportation the whole time. So it was really neat to connect with communities on the ground. And yeah, I have just so many amazing stories of just connections that I had that I made with people. And yeah.
Yourself? Did you find yourself thinking of, insofar as like had to do with being a physical person, had to do with actually having a body that is not white? Like, did you find yourself thinking and rethinking like how you present yourself publicly?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, it's been a process. So like, I've been very much encountering God through, at least in part, through the Black Madonna for over a couple years now, but I wasn't publicly talking about that, partially because of the audience that I tend to engage. Although I have been transitioning intentionally to a broader audience. I think the process of seeing myself in these just incredible images of God in these incredible spaces. Like not all of, so I visited 18 Black Madonnas. Not all of them are in these like cathedrals. So not all of them are in these like super impressive spaces. Some of them are in like teeny tiny village churches where like I had to walk like 3 days just to like get to the village. Yeah. But no matter what, they're seen as they're revered, and they are seen as both immanent and transcendent. They're seen as both love and the source of love, and also the source of love and action. And so, I think it has been really empowering for me. And I have pictures of the black Madonnas and statues of Black Madonnas all over my house. It's actually pretty funny. My sister is just like, everywhere you go, like literally everywhere you go, you see them. And I think part of that has emboldened me to show up more unapologetically in this world as who I am, because I've always wrestled to believe that I'm created in the image of God too, because I didn't have any images of it. In fact, the images that I saw, and then the way I was treated by the sort of mainstream Christian church, suggested that God was as far from God as possible as a Black woman. I've been reading a lot about like the way Reagan, who really worked hand in hand with you know, the Christian right, just slapped this like welfare queen label on all black mothers are like potential welfare queens, you know? And so like, rather than seeing like Black motherhood as divine, which is what it is, like we've been just given these labels that suggest that we're the opposite of divine. And they're like across our entire culture, you know, these labels are used and applied and impact social policy and impact incarceration rates and whether your, you know, kids get put in the foster system or not. So I think just growing up in this culture and, internalizing so many of those beliefs, it was really powerful for me to, you know, encounter all these images in the United States that I was able to find in like vintage shops and just online or whatever. And then also to go and to walk and to, see these images in these statues that are still standing after all these wars. I mean, like, there's so many stories of people in these villages, like, especially the women in these villages, like, saving the statues from wars and bombs and from, like, Roman troops. I mean, some of them are, like, 1,500, 1,800 years old and have been cared for by their community.
Which in and of itself is this...
Unbelievable,
like,
yeah.
It's this wonderful confirmation that this is not, like, which is often the way... something like, you know, what seems like the introduction of blackness into theological conversations.
It's like, new. Yeah.
Like this is new idea that these liberals have brought to the table to make things complicated.
Yeah.
But that's not even remotely the case. It's whiteness that is newer to theology.
Okay. Yeah. The first image that we have of Jesus is this like beautiful Coptic fresco from 235. And Jesus is black and surrounded by black and brown people. That's the earliest known image we have of Jesus.
Yeah.
So white Jesus is the, like, you know...
He's the new kid on the block.
Is the new kid on the block.
To make a white reference.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Things with our remaining time, if you've still got a little headspace left. One is I'd like to revisit a not really a character. It is a character. Ben is a character in the book, but he's not really a character. He's an actual person.
Flashback.
I want to go back to Ben in the book Disunity in Christ. And I won't retell the whole thing, but there's this person. There's a friend of yours from earlier on in your life named Ben. That you feature in your book Disunity in Christ, and there's kind of this moment of like recognizing some distance, some cultural distance, and then later on in the book coming around to a kind of an appreciation for him as a person. Can you really quickly retell like that bit of that story and your relationship with Ben?
I can try to remember. Yeah, so I went to this like relatively small church, and there weren't a lot of single people, because, you know, it was a Christian church. And Ben was one of the few single people besides me. And he was the opposite of me, theologically, politically, culturally, racially,
right,
like every way. And also just had a difficult personality that I think that's like consensus. It's not just my opinion. I think a lot of people saw him as difficult. And I think I got a lot of fuel out of self-righteous condemnation of him. And so I start my book Disunity in Christ just naming that and saying, hey, you know, in all of my critical evaluation of Ben, which really just made me feel a lot better about myself, I lost sight of the fact that he's my sibling, he's my family. And so the sort of the invitation was to, you know, think about how can I engage with Ben differently that doesn't necessarily, you know, he has some beliefs that I honestly legitimately see as like problematic around guns and military and stuff like that. So it's not to say like we all have to agree, but, you know, how can I engage with Ben honoring the image of God in him?
Yeah. So, and then you come around in the book that you like. And there's a section of your book that's called Ben Again, and you recount this moment. There were fires. I think it was in Santa Barbara, fires in Southern California.
And he goes
about doing this relatively heroic thing about going and rescuing people.
Yeah.
And there might even there. I don't remember exactly. But there might have been puppies. I don't remember, but there was something really heroic on his part. And sort of the championing, like, hey, here's a unique role he plays. So like the story stands out, and it does play like an emotionally kind of uplifting portion of the book. And my question, as I've been rereading the book, because I've read the book a few times, and as I reread it for this conversation, I wonder if that relationship or that story would happen differently now. Like, does that happen? Like, on this side of the marker, yeah, on this side of the 2016 election, yeah, does the engagement with Ben look different for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think I have a lot of, there's a lot about that book that I probably would write differently now, which I don't think is a bad thing. No. I think, you know, it would be scary if I would write it exactly the same now. I guess that would mean I hadn't grown at all or changed. But yeah, I mean, I think it's less likely that Ben and I would even be at the same church now for a lot of reasons, okay, because I think our church communities have become even more politically stratified, yes, since the election. But I also think that I would have liked to have seen younger me, like 2011 me or however old I was, whenever it was that I was writing this, being a little more intentional about my own self-care and about whether, yes, like, it's important for me to be able to honor the image of God in Ben, but also it was really important for me to honor the image of God in me, yes, too. Yes. And I don't think I was able to do that to the extent that I'm able to do now. And so because I'm just as interested in honoring the image of God in me as I am in anyone else, there are some people that I'm not as likely to engage with. It's not because I don't care about them as human beings, but there are a lot of people who have been so shaped by, who have been shaped by our culture and have not interrogated that at all. Like, we live in a white supremacist patriarchal culture. That's just like a reality. And we're shaped by that because we're social beings who are influenced by the sermons we hear and the music we listen to and the people who are on our Supreme Court and the teachers that we have. And I think all of us have to interrogate that. Like, how have I been shaped by this culture that automatically values whiteness, mm-hmm, and maleness, uh-huh, over everybody else? Because we all have been poisoned to a certain extent by that. And so I'm less likely to engage with or try to share spiritual spaces with people who are not doing that work.
Or even share in the spaces that are defined by that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Because I'm so committed to honoring the Black female me.
And not as protective, to be clear. Like, you're not trying to protect yourself as a Black woman. You're trying to say, this is part of what it looks like to, like, live in, you know, to use older language, to live in and be the image of God. If we're going to be serious about this theologically, you're not just trying to defend yourself because, like, oh, I don't want to be triggered and feel sad. You're literally making, like creating cultural public space for an expression of, like, a real life expression of the divine, so that, like, exactly, people can see God as God and not as white male God.
Well, yeah. I mean, in order to be in a relationship with Ben, I had to silence parts of who I was.
There it is.
And that's dishonoring to the image of God in me. And in order to be in a lot of the Christian spaces that I spent a lot of time in, I had to silence parts of who I was, whether it was my Blackness or my femaleness or the combination of both. And that was dishonoring to the image of God in me. And I'm not willing to do that anymore. And I also think that talking to the Bens is white men's work. Yeah. And so
it's part of why I do the podcast.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, you know, like, I think part of my need to be Ben's friend came out of an agnosticism, which, hey, I respect you if you're an agnostic, but I'm not an agnostic. I am someone who believes in God. And so, what was interesting was I was engaging with all these communities and individuals, cutting off parts of who I was in order to do that, because I thought, well, if I don't do it, then who will?
Yeah.
Which is like, well, why do I claim to believe in God? Yeah. If that's what I think.
That's really strong. have this memory, but when the very first time I met you was in Nashville, Tennessee, at a Q conference. There was a sandwich shop that I was in, and you came in, and you and I started talking, and it came to find out that you were going to be presenting later on in the day or the next day. And I asked you what was it you were going to be presenting on, and you communicated, and then you went on and you said something, and I actually wrote this too when I went to book this. I said, this has been in my head since then. You went on to talk about the where you were in the program and what you were surrounded by, and that you were the one, on that day, you were the only female that would be on the stage, and you were the only Black person in the entire lineup. You were literally like, and what you had was, I think, 6 minutes.
Three.
You had three. That was, let's be clear. So you had three, that you had 3 minutes, and that earlier in the day, day.
At 18. Yeah, I remember that.
So earlier in the day, there was someone, and there was a gentleman who had done a presentation on manliness.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that was.
Part of why I, and this is not a question, this is just me setting you up to tell you this is why I wanted this interview, is part of the reason I've paid attention to your work since then is like, I didn't see that at the time. Like, so I'm thankful for your work. I'm thankful for you. If you want to put me in the Ben category, I'm thankful for your approach and your communication, because I hadn't really seen it. I thought it was, and this is so terrible, I thought I was like great that there was this presentation and you were going to have this. Oh, that's really cool that we get to have this conversation. What you were saying is like, hold on. Yeah. I mean, that's neat, but it needs to be more than neat. This can't be a sideshow anymore, that like, hey, Blackness, femininity, like womanhood. These can't be sideshows anymore, where there's this great big white male thing happening, and then we're going to give a moment, a literal moment, to something that isn't white, that isn't male. And I literally, I thought that what was happening there was like, it was great, it was fascinating, because it was touching all these interesting cultural points for me. And it literally took you to say, as a presenter, here's the spot they gave me. What do you think that says about who God is and about the God that they're talking about across the street? Because that was the thing you said, is like, says, what you said was, it's not just what it says about me. It's what it says about what they think about God. And that stuck in my mind and has since then. And it was part of why I paid attention to your work, is like, if I'm really going to be engaged with God, I have to full blown be open to like shock, surprise, repentance. Like, I'm constantly going to have to be turning away from things that I believe know to be true in order to actually know divine things. And that was a moment for me that was and continues to be revolutionary.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. I will say, I'm more convinced now that God redeems than ever.
That's good.
Because if I could do that again, I would not speak at Q. So, but yeah, I think that's what's really neat, is that we all are on our journeys and we're all doing the best we can. And we have this amazing God who takes what we're offering and turns it into something that's like a lot more beautiful than we can even imagine. So...
Last little trick here is I normally do a thing with guests. This is kind of a practice of lexicon. There are words that we use regularly in our work, that you use regularly in your work, that like you hold differently than the person next to you. So when, as an example, we talk about divinity, you will mean divine in a way differently than Andy Crouch will mean divine.
Yes.
Not on the whole broadly, you're in a completely different category, but as like the sort of on the spectrum of, and the sort of like the broad glance at what it looks like for something or for divine to be reality, you're holding that differently. So I'd love to walk through a few words here. And the way it works is I'm just going to say the word.
Okay.
And then you can either define the word, you can tell a quick story, like whatever it is that comes in you that's sort of definitive of how that word sits in you. like you go for it until you're done. And then like, we'll kind of walk through the list.
Okay.
Theology.
Practice. When I think of theology, I think of my practices. And it's so funny that I'm going to quote Stanley Hauerwas because I don't often, but he says, people don't have values. Used cars have values. People have practices.
Strong.
Yeah. And I, when I think of theology, it's like, what am I doing? How am I interacting with the world? That's my theology.
Christ.
Is a black woman too.
Blackness.
Blackness is the image of God in black people. That's a James Cone quote.
That's a gorgeous quote. The divine.
I think the divine is most present in the spaces that we think are not sacred. In our brokenness, in our sin, in our distance from what we would consider to be sacred, in our disappointment, in our grief. That's where the divine is most present.
Excellent. Dr. Lieben, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me. It's nice to reconnect in this way. It's just a cool full circle. So.
Amen. Have a good rest of your day.
See you. Okay, thanks. Bye.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of the At Sea podcast. If you'd like to follow up with anything Christina Cleveland is doing, you can find her at Christina with an E, Cleveland.com. From there, you can jump to her Black Madonna project, her work at Patreon, her book, Disunity in Christ, and the stuff she's writing and speaking on now. There is a world of information and insight and wisdom at ChristinaCleveland.com. If you are interested in supporting this podcast, you can find us at Patreon as well. Just search my name, Justin McRoberts, and we'll be there. We'd love to have you on the team. Until next time.